Today's Daily DVR is brought to you by our presenting sponsor, Cufflinks.com. All January long, 30% off all NCAA and NFL merchandise at Cufflinks.com/DVR, baby. Use that /DVR so they know that you heard about them here. Use promo code FOOTBALL30. And don't forget, go over to our Facebook page. That's Facebook.com/DailyDVR. And you can join in our football divisional playoffs pick 'em. What we got? We got about 10 or so entries so far after a day. I like that. So we're doing this pick 'em. And if you win, if you pick the correct teams, you'll be entered to win a prize that you get to choose. And you can check out the awesome prizes you can win on our Facebook page. That's Daily DVR on Facebook. But also, go to cufflinks.com/DVR. Use code DVR20. Get 20% off anything you order. No minimum. All month long. 30% off football, baby. Celebrate the Clemson Tigers win by getting, hey, get a pin. Get a tie clip, you know? Look, I'm looking at some cufflinks right here. They look fantastic. They're beautiful. They got that big orange paw there. So celebrate, go to cufflinks.com/DVR, use code FOOTBALL30 to get 30% off NCAA and NFL all January long. Let's do this. Today is Wednesday, January 9th, 2019, and this is Daily DVR. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. It's our Wednesday show. How y'all doing? Been having a fun week. Had a good show on Monday. This Friday, I'm going to have Justin Thomas of Top Shelf Fandom on. Check out Top Shelf Fandom on YouTube. I'll include that link in the show notes. Justin's fantastic, and we're going to be talking about the Game of Thrones casting news, the prequel news. We'll probably get into talking a little bit, Season 8, Game of Thrones stuff. Who knows? We might even put that up on the YouTube, you know? You never know. Check us out at DVR Podcast on the Twitter. Go to our Facebook page, Daily DVR. Remember, enter our football pick 'em, baby. That's right. This is fun. I like this. I owe it all to Brett. Brett created this idea. So shout out to Brett. Everyone who we're having fun, we're picking the teams this weekend. I'm excited. Yesterday on our Patreon show, which you can get by going to patreon.com/DVR, I talked all about football and I gave my picks. My picks. Let me tell you something. I didn't pick the New England Patriots. Are you shocked? I'm a Jets fan. I didn't pick the New England Patriots. Sorry, John. All right. But today, I've got lots of news. We got lots of stuff to talk about. I'm going to go over this American cinematographers list and these films that were listed. And I'm going to give some of my films that I thought should have been listed that are more recent films. And I thought that would be a fun thing to do. I also have some feedback from Brett, which you can send your feedback to dvrpodcast@gmail.com. We appreciate all the feedback. But let's get into Brett's feedback. Hi, Axel. That's me. Hi, Brett. I just listened to your listener top 10 episode. That was great last week. Thanks, everyone, for participating. And it was awesome. Agreed. I loved hearing everyone's opinions and thusly recommendations, as clearly there is plenty I haven't watched yet. I did not include honorable mentions in my list of movies, but while it's fresh on my mind, I did want to give a shout out to a few that barely missed my cut. Leave No Trace. Ah, set here in Portland. I would definitely want to see that. Eighth Grade, Bo Burnham. That was supposed to be fantastic. I got that from the library, but the wife and I didn't watch it. The Tale on HBO. That was supposed to be great. Caliber on Netflix. Had not heard of that. And Bird Box. Bird Box. Got a little Bird Box news today, too. May have rounded out my top 15 if I went that far. There were also a couple that I intended to watch but didn't, so what I'm dubbing as my neglectful admissions list would include Fallout and A Quiet Place. Oh, A Quiet Place is great. It's kind of cool that you saw Bird Box before A Quiet Place because there's so many, I think so many people went into Bird Box thinking it's a quiet place. So that's kind of cool. Of course, any movie that I failed to watch last year, I'm going to blame on the MoviePass fiasco, which deserves its own dissertation sometime. I saw somebody today tweeted out like this, my last movie pass day or something, but I still got like $250 worth of movies for $84. But then with all the hassles and like, I mean, is that still around? Would you, I guess it's gone now, right? You had to, it would be like, okay, you can see this movie between 4 PM and 4:03 PM in this town at this theater, but only in theater A. And no, you're not allowed to buy popcorn. Now I'm going to get into some Bird Box spoilers that Brett has written here in his interpretation of Bird Box and kind of its metaphors. So if you have not seen Bird Box or if you are wary of spoilers, please skip ahead about 3 to 4 minutes, maybe 3 to 5, and we'll go from there. So here we go. Spoiler alert. 3, 2, 1. Brett writes, speaking of Bird Box, you had asked us at the end of your Venom review. I did a Venom review on the Patreon New Year's Day. What we thought the metaphor was for Bird Box. As I tend to do, I was going to try to explain it from a scientific perspective. So get ready for me to get science philosophical on your ass. I'm ready, Brett. A spiritual theory that I covet is that although we human beings can only perceive three dimensions with our five senses, we actually extend into higher dimensional space where one's consciousness is making connections that they are not tangibly perceiving. I totally agree with this, Brett. And this is, I think this falls in the realm of, you know, the old Arthur C. Clarke saying, any advanced technology will be perceived as magic, I guess, by a lesser civilization. I always screw up the exact quote, but you catch my drift. We just don't understand this yet. So it sounds like you're getting spiritual and all that, but actually I think that could be quite scientific. It's like some people have the ability to see light in a different way than other people do. Not ultraviolet, but different representations of light. Their eyes are able to perceive them, or sound. Or how about people who have synesthesia, right, where they can taste a color, or they can smell a feeling like really deeply, which we all have in a sense, though, right? We call that like sense memory. But that's connected to something of that nature as well, right? All right, so Brett continues. This is where we get to the spoilery stuff. The monster in Bird Box, yes, there's a monster, could be a five-dimensional alien that stays hidden from three-dimensional physical space most of the time, but can still wreak havoc on one's consciousness. Since the human brain relies heavily on visual information in order to associate with the outside world, the monster can only implant its connection to your consciousness through your visual cortex, i.e. you need to lay eyes on it for a split second and then its tentacles are in you. Once that connection is made, your perception of the world is filtered. It filters out everything but the worst in you of what you're capable of. For most people with a moral conscience, their soul is filled with such dread that they can no longer tolerate living. For a percentage of people with no moral conscience or who are already living life near that darkness threshold, they are largely unaffected and are even happy that the rest of the world is becoming as they've always perceived it. They encourage everyone to open their eyes. To them, this is a process of natural selection for our species. Brett, that's fucking awesome. I think that's correct. That's my long-winded sci-fi explanation of what's happening. But I suppose the lesson is, though we cannot eliminate the good conscience out of a person, we might be able to eliminate it from a population if we aren't careful and if the people in power are not good people. Everybody should go vote for good, smart people. Hear, hear, Brett. Totally agree. That's great interpretation. That is a fantastic interpretation. Because that's, I see what you're saying there. That's fantastic, Brett. I love that. They're saying, open your eyes, open your eyes. You see that? This is the truth. You know, it's so often when, you know, that's why I often disagree with, say, people are bad or, you know, everybody, like people have bad attitude. Ah, everybody's bad and out for themselves anyway. I don't feel that way. And I think, though, that that's interesting the way Brett says that for people who, this is a great line right here. For most people with a moral conscience, their soul is filled with such dread that they can no longer tolerate living, meaning when they see it, right? Because what we have within ourselves is the ability to see the good. But in seeing the good, you know what the bad is, right? You have to have like a healthy fear of it and understand it, right? And see that it is not right. It is bad. But the bad people, because they're living in it, cannot see that. So they want you to open. But then they're saying the converse of, which is open your eyes, which sounds, that's what's interesting about the film, right? There's an interesting part about there too, isn't there, Brett? The kind of 1984-ish quality here and why I think there is a political and kind of social aspect there, which you're hitting upon in your last statement there, which is that it sounds like they're saying, be free, right? Open your eyes, be free, see it, see it. But really what they're seeing is not what you, what is reality or what is truth. It's kind of the worst, you know? It is all that fear. And then they become, in effect, the bastions. They're going out there to spread the they're evangelizing the aliens taking over of this planet. And I think that's really interesting. If I got that right, that's interesting. That's the first time I kind of talked it out. But I think I understand what you're saying, Brett. I dig that. And I also find interesting the bird box thing too, is what is the bird box, right? Like the bird is in the box to warn of the aliens, but are we the birds in the box? You know what I'm saying, man? Who's the bird and what's the box, baby? Brett doing it right. All right. I love it, man. I love it. That's fantastic. All right. Let's get into some news. The first news is I saw this just a couple days ago, and that's that David, and thank you. Thank you again for that email. And remember, everyone, you can email us at dvrpodcast@gmail.com. All right. David Fincher and Deadpool director are uniting to make a Netflix animated anthology series for adults. So this is pretty cool. So what's the guy's name? Tim Miller and David Fincher. Love, Death, and Robots. So it's like a sci-fi animated anthology series, and it continues Netflix's push into animation and adult animation and anime. And I think that that's fantastic. And since we're on Netflix, there was an article that came out, which I think, I mean, we're always talking about this on the show, and it was from Vox, called Netflix's Upcoming Content Crisis. I shared this on the Facebook page. Go check it out in one chart. And basically what this chart shows is the most viewed Netflix shows as a percentage of all Netflix views, okay? So The Office is 7.1% of all the views on Netflix, okay? So then it goes down Friends, Parks and Rec, Grey's Anatomy, New Girl, blah, 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 all the way Frasier, The Flash. And these are all things that are going to get taken away by Disney, Fox, Warner Media, or NBC Universal. And what it all adds up to is a very high percentage of what people are watching on Netflix. But look, okay, I mean, I had a disagreement. I tweeted this out and I said, hey, for me, this doesn't really mean anything because I normally watch, I watch a lot of Netflix originals. I probably watch more. It's probably like 60-40, but I watch more Netflix original stuff, whether it's docs, films, even if it's foreign co-productions or stuff they bought, right? Or branded as Netflix, right? Which some of this, with this other stuff is not. Like, it's not like Netflix presents Friends, right? Netflix presents Frasier. That's not happening. I watched this and I tweeted it out. And Craig, who was on the show talking about Star Wars with me, lined up, right? He said, I don't hardly watch any of their stuff, and I watch a lot of this old stuff, you know? And that's true. I think that a lot of people do watch this, and you have Netflix on in the background or something of this nature, right? But my thing is this. Okay, now my wife is a research scientist. I've talked a little bit about this. And she would probably say, this makes me think, she'd probably say to me this. Okay, if all of these shows add up to 25 or 30%, maybe even 20% of what people watch on Netflix, if you take them away, the question is, will people leave Netflix to find those shows, or will they just watch different shows on Netflix? Right? Like, that's the gamble. And that is why Netflix has been making a mad dash, and why every Friday, Thursday night is now Netflix night in the world of television. I mean, think about that. That is new this year. So last year, if I was doing this show, I would not, and I looked every Thursday and Friday, I would go every couple weeks, and then Netflix would drop one, two, three. Then it just kind of started picking up and picking up. And now, literally, every Thursday or Friday, they're dropping 5 to 10 new things. Now, a good portion of them are still co-productions. And when these Netflix originals are rolled out, people don't always mention that. And they're picking it up from, for instance, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. And they're not only co-productions, they're co-distributing and co-producing in some aspects. A lot of times they're picking up some of the production after they've begun to distribute it on their service. And the service has, you know, the people have watched it, giving them the numbers to prove that they should now invest in a second season. That's a secondary way. Netflix doesn't just pick up shows that were canceled. It also enters into co-production agreements with corporation companies, production companies that are making foreign, a lot of Australian stuff. You see this Norwegian stuff, a lot of that kind of stuff, right? Now they're doing it all over the world. I just saw something. They're doing a Japanese show. So Terrace House, they co-produced, they picked it up. And they pay for it, even though it premieres in Japan and all that kind of stuff on the regular channel. People might not even realize that Netflix is now invested in it, right? It's an investment. And we only notice it. It's like I think people notice this more because you have to tune to it. But if you had to go to a movie theater that only showed Disney movies, and then a Sony movie, but distributed by this, you would know, right? So this is stuff you don't necessarily have to know this, nor is it of great interest to a lot of people. To me, it is, hopefully to you listening. But the point I'm making is this. If The Office is not on Netflix, might I watch, The Ranch? I mean, I'm not gonna. I guess I answered my own question. No. But I might, right? They're creating these shows. And I think in the long run, when I think about how much I pay for HBO or how much a person would pay for HBO, even with HBO Go, right? Netflix is still a better deal. When I think about Amazon, when I think about Hulu, besides I pay 99 cents for Hulu, and thank you, shout out to Andy, he's right, if you binge stuff on Hulu, the commercials stop. My wife has confirmed this now on multiple platforms, on the Xbox, PS4, and through our Vizio TV. As soon as you get past like the half of the second episode that you're watching, if you let it roll over, or definitely by the third, you're not watching any commercials at all. It's just rolling right over it. It stops for a second, it spins, and then it comes right back. It's just like in the old days when you watched movies on TV shows on VHS, right? Where they had such pronounced breaks, da-dum-dum, and then it would fade, and then it'd fade back in, do-do-do-do-do, with the with the wide shot there, the establishing shot. So long story short, this is a great article, and I suggest that you read it. I just wanted to talk it out a little bit. And, you know, Justin, I think maybe this is something we're going to end up talking about in the future again, too, because we've had good chats about it. But I believe, I mean, he has a great point. Things, and this is part of his point, which is that they're going to cancel things. Things move. There's no stability. And it's frustrating. I agree with that. But I also have always been the type of person to think, hey, even if they just make a pilot of something cool, that's cool. They made something. So I'm just all about creating stuff, you know, and doing it. So I think that that's kind of, I think it's exciting that Netflix is making so much stuff, Amazon, giving people an opportunity to create stuff and form new fandoms, new, you know, just new art, you know? And I think that's fantastic. So I do disagree with them. I have to say my final premise, and if anyone wants to write in and disagree with me, please do. I think that this article is wrong. I really do. And I think it's based on a faulty premise. And I think that the premise it's based on is that people choose a service for specific content. I don't think that's true. I think people choose a service for its ability to fulfill their moods and desires with content. And I believe that Netflix is doing that. And I think that they're intelligently, they are looking at this list and they're saying, we need an Office, Friends, part, and they need to, that's the only thing I think Netflix needs to do better at. I'm just surprised. It's almost like they're waiting, because think about it. There should be like 50 half-hour comedy shows on Netflix. Everybody wants a freaking sitcom, or every comedian or whatever, right? But they've resisted that because it would be a lot of bad stuff. And so I have to give them credit with the stuff that they're kind of curating and the way they're curating stuff. And I think that this recent emphasis on kids stuff, animated stuff, niche stuff is really good, because what it gets in the hardcore people like us. And then you get the bring out the more wide ranging stuff. Like, I'll give you an example, like The Ranch or something, which I think actually a lot of people watch. Now, I don't like that show, but I hear people talk about it and I see that people watch it. And I was reading some articles saying, oh, it's a surprising hit on Netflix, you know? And so I don't know. There's other stuff that they've done too, but they've tried to tend more to be towards what would be considered not vanity projects, more auteur driven kind of stuff. So I think I don't see why Netflix hasn't gone to Mike Schur and them, you know, from Good Place and Parks and Rec, and they're just being like, here's $1 billion, bro. Make 20 shows. Go. They could cast them and shoot them, and they'd be so freaking cheap, because they could shoot them on a set that has like 6 different rooms. You know what I mean? I mean, think about Parks and Rec. Really? How many different, when you watch that again, you realize that it's shot in like 8 rooms. But like the whole series. So it's interesting to me, but this is a great article. Okay. I went a little long on that, but that's worth it. Let me try to include that in the old show notes. I'm going to move that over there. So I save it. And once again, that David Fincher and Tim Miller Love Death Robots. I think this looks cool. The pictures look awesome. Look this up. You got to see this. Maybe I should put this in the show. I should put all my links in the show notes, but I have problems with the links being not coming out right when I do my WordPress stuff, but I got to fix that. Anyway, let's move on. So, let's see. We're getting into some Star Trek stuff here, and who was it? Alex Kurtzman was talking about this Star Trek animated series. Oh, remember this? Lower Decks from Rick and Morty writer Mike McCahan. And they've been releasing these Star Trek short treks on the CBS All Access. I don't know if anybody has that or has been watching them. I just have been letting them go. I know there's a podcast, I think it's Fantastic Geek, that covers those. And I am just waiting until I get a free trial for the second season of Star Trek Discovery. And I have no qualms about saying, because I can't unless they've added a lot of stuff, still I can't believe what are they doing with that thing? Are they just like, you know, they don't need to invest in it. So it's just like for Star Trek fans. But anyway, let's see. There was a little note that he talked about Picard, and this is what I really wanted to talk about. But just basically that the Star Trek, the Lower Decks things is happening, and it's going to be more kid-focused, because when it was first reported, I think because of it's Rick and Morty, that's a little bit older. But it's going to be more kid-focused, which I think is fun. Because remember Deep Space Nine, when the kids would always be running around? What's his name's kid and the Ferengi's kid too, right? Those were a lot of fun little things that they've gotten into. And I've always thought, and I've never understood this, how there has never been a Starfleet Academy TV show. I mean, come on. That is just like the lowest of low-hanging fruit for Star Trek. How is there not a Star Trek Starfleet Academy on like the CW? And there's like, they could make a whole channel of them. It would be great. They could do like one where there's like a Nancy Drew one. They could do another one where there's like a, you know, some fighter pilot. They could do another science one where they do, you know, they're traveling through time. I mean, it would be so cool to do. They could do like Hogwarts Starfleet. All right, I'm giving them too many ideas, but this is not going to probably be what it's going to be. It's going to probably be more like the new Star Wars show that is really just a straight-up kid show. The new Star Wars show is fun. What's it called? Resistance? But it's the total kid show. It's like for kids 5 and under. Even my son, who's 6, thinks it's a little kiddie. So that tells you something. He still watched Curious George. But Curious George is actually for life. I have Curious George for life. You know how Tupac had Thug Life on his tummy? I have Curious Life on my tummy because I love Curious George for real. I love him. All right, so Jean-Luc Picard, here's a little bit of news about this series. Events will be set. Okay, it's Patrick Stewart reprising his iconic role 15 years after the end of the events of Next Generation. So events will be set after both the failed coup of Romulans by Shin Zan in Star Trek Nemesis. That was Tom Hardy. Does anyone remember that? And that planet's destruction, as mentioned in 2009 Star Trek. In the time since, Kurtzman says, Picard's life was radically altered by the dissolution of the Romulan Empire. He goes on to say Picard is leading a whole new life in the new episodes, and Patrick Stewart only agreed to return to the role if they were going to do something drastically different. He threw down an amazing gauntlet and said, if we do this, I want it to be so different. I want it to be both what people remember, but also not what they're expecting at all. Otherwise, why do it? So this is pretty cool. He put through a 3-page document outlining what he wanted to do, and Patrick Stewart liked it, and they decided to do it. I think that is... I'm really excited about this, and I think that I like the way that Patrick Stewart has gotten involved in like X-Men and all that. I mean, come on, Logan, though, I don't think it was as great as some people claim that it was. It was very good. It was very good. But like a lot of this, I mean, I don't even remember all the fighting at the end was just like a blur to me. But that's part of the movie. You know, I can't complain about that. At least it wasn't shot like a Transformers movie. I like the way that Patrick Stewart tries to bring like what he brought to Next Generation, which is like a Shakespearean respectability, not only for character, but for story and continuity. And you could see that he cared in Logan, right? Like he was acting his ass off in that. And also in The Next Generation. So, and the films too. Like when he becomes a Borg, come on, man. That was sick. So I think it's awesome that I wanted to read that because it gives me hope, right? Like this CBS thing, hey, at least they're letting him do some cool Star Trek stuff. Like I'm just going to stop making fun of this, the CBS All Access or limited, I should call it CBS kind of all access, like limited Star Trek access, but they're doing fun stuff. And I think that's super cool that that's how they kind of agreed to do this. I like that story. All right. A little bit more news. Speaking of Bird Box, this came out over the weekend and this was huge news. So according to Nielsen, which now has decided to not have thousands of random people write in notebooks like they did for 50 years. Bird Box was a runaway success. 26 million people watched it in the first 7 days of release. Now, okay, Netflix said that 45 million viewers watched it, but Nielsen only covers viewers in the United States. So, you know, maybe there's a disparity there. Please, my neighbor is running some kind of blower or something, so please excuse that noise in the background, but I'm going to continue. You probably can't even hear it. But anyway, I think that this is the second time in about the past 6 months there was another company that claimed it had broken the Netflix viewer algorithm and, you know, this many people watched the first season of, what was it, Luke Cage or Iron Fist or something like that. You remember that? And now we have Nielsen saying, and of course, Netflix will not say that they're right, right? Because not only did Netflix say, which is very rare, that 45 million people watch Bird Box, probably aided in large part by weird memes, okay? Like I've been sending to members of my family, like Big Bird Box and Ernie and Bert Box and all types of like, or this is another one. So if you're a collector, the group or whatever you're in, whatever you visit or on the internet has probably had some meme where she's carrying the kids and she's passing the aisle. Like I'm into Lego and I collect Gundam, as I've talked about on this show, the Japanese models. And so on those pages where I look at the different stuff, they'll be like passing an aisle of Gundam and it'll be like Sandra Bullock holding her kid, you know, like, don't look. You know, as a euphemism for consumerism. There you go, Brett. There's another one. But I find this to be very interesting that Nielsen, it's like, you know, the old saying, you've got to get ahead of this story, right? You've got to create the narrative. Well, by not saying how many people watched something, Netflix saw some people trying to create a narrative. And now they're trying to get ahead of it by saying, hey, look, Bird Box is blowing up. Somebody's going to claim that they hear that Nielsen's going to release it. So they release it. And this stuff actually happens. And then they release, 45 million. And it's like twice or 19 million more than what Nielsen said. Right. So does this mean anything? I don't believe either of these numbers because Netflix doesn't have to. I mean, Netflix is a publicly traded company Do they have to, when they release a number like that, does it have to be verified? I'm not sure. I don't know the legalities of releasing a number like that. But I know enough to know that the studios do it when they talk about film sales and tickets. So come on. And all the, you know, Nielsen has been a joke forever. It's hilarious to me. And I'm in podcasting, so I should say, like, people ask me, what's the exact number of people who download? It's impossible to tell. It's almost impossible to tell. There's services that are provided, but what I mean is because of streams, because some places download and then stream, right? It's served in so many different ways. So it's just funny that digital content, which when I was coming up in the 90s and writing about digital content, when everyone had AOL and everyone was saying, when we have broadband, we'll be able to watch TV on the, it was like a huge thing. They'll be able to, oh my gosh, they'll be able to send a movie. The internet is just like TV. It's a cable line. You know, I wrote a whole thing about walled gardens for, what was that? Broadcasting and cable in 2000, which is now, I mean, my article should be groundbreaking. I'm surprised people haven't brought it up. I should be asked to be a speaker I should be doing one of those speeches that people do, a Theodore thing or whatever it's called. But this is now the reality that even in this digital age, you don't know the exact numbers. And I think Netflix does. That's a little bit easier, right? You own the service. It's a straight line. Someone hits a button. I think Netflix knows everything. You don't think they know exactly how many people in Bandersnatch chose the oats and honey instead of the Fruit Loops? They know. They know. And then they've run that through an algorithm that the people who chose the Fruit Loops were more likely to watch Friends than they were to watch The Office. So they do not prefer a workplace-based comedy. They prefer one set outside of a workplace. And then they say, oh, maybe we should create one like that. Trust me, that's what they're doing. So anyway, interesting little numbers, Warren. We'll see if this leads to Netflix starting releasing more numbers. That's what I'm interested in. And will then you see them perhaps, you know, teaming up with another company to release the numbers and working like that? It's interesting. We shall see what happens. All right. What do I got to go? I've been going on. Let me take a little break for an ad for cufflinks.com, baby. All right, cufflinks.com. I want to remind everybody once again, go over to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/group/dailydvr. You can win. I've got four awesome prizes up there. I've got two ties, a pair of socks, and some cufflinks. I think I got Star Wars socks. I've got dopey cufflinks, which are awesome. I was thinking about keeping those. Those are so cool. I've got a Millennium Falcon tie. And I think, what was the other tie I've got? I don't know. You know what? You go over and check. What's the last item? I'm not looking at it right in front of me. So you go to facebook.com/group/dailydvr, and you can see that. Enter that contest, because what the contest is for is you to win some awesome stuff from cufflinks.com. So go to cufflinks.com/DVR, use code FOOTBALL30. All month long, NCAA and NFL is on sale for you. And you know what I like to do, like I always like to do at the mid-break? I just like to look at cufflinks.com. And I'm obsessed with some of this Jet stuff. I think I have to get it. I think I have to order it for myself. I'm not even going to say, hey, Cufflink, send me the Jet stuff. I mean, no, I'm going to order it. I got to order some Jet stuff, man. Oh, I'm so excited. The Jets are getting a new head coach. Sports, that's another thing about that, is sports is all year round. So if you're thinking about buying something for someone that's coming, an event in the future or as a gift, it doesn't matter. Like, as a Jets fan, birthday, Halloween, Christmas, Arbor Day, Earth Day, you can give me something of the New York Jets and I want it. I love it. For Christmas, my mother-in-law gave me this little tiny Jets helmet. Now look, she might have thought to herself, oh look, it's just a little tiny Jets helmet. Isn't that cute? But do you know what I'm going to do? I have just started painting Gundam, and I'm going to paint the Gundam in Jet's colors and put this helmet on it. And you know what else I might do? That Gundam might be wearing some cufflinks, some Jets cufflinks from cufflinks.com. So go to cufflinks.com/DVR, use code FOOTBALL30, and get 30% off all NCAA and NFL merchandise. Also, use code DVR20 and get 20% off your order, no minimum. All right? At all times, baby. DVR20. cufflinks.com/DVR. And thank you to Cufflinks for sponsoring the show. They're fantastic to work with. They're great people, family-owned company. So you know when you're buying something from them, you can trust them. They're good people. cufflinks.com/DVR. Now back to the show. All right, we're back, people. And what I want to do is I want to go over this great list that this year the American Society of Cinematographers listed their 100 best shot films. Now, they made a, I like what they did here, okay? Because the organizer, member Steven Fearberg, kind of did a little interview here with everyone. And this is what I like. Wherever this list was, people wrote about it, but they always included this blurb. It's like they said to them, you have to do this, right? Because we don't want to just say what it is, okay? The list is not strictly the best shot films ever, but it is their effort to recognize an artist who is an essential contributor to the magic of cinema. We are trying to call attention to the most significant achievements of the cinematographer's art. We do not presume to call one masterful achievement better than another. I really like this. This trend that now I'm going to call the PTA effect, because he said to John Krasinski, never say that a movie was bad. Say that it wasn't for you. Right? It wasn't your thing. It wasn't your bag, but you appreciate it because we all work so hard to make what we make. We have to have each other's back. That's the way I feel when I talk about Game of Thrones. Now, I see people slamming Game of Thrones on the internet. The other day, I was in a little Facebook group. I go in and somebody released a video. Oh, what went wrong with Game of Thrones? Oh, they messed it up. Lazy writing, this and that. And all it felt like saying was, you're making a video. They made a video. Aren't we all making videos here? Nobody's lazy. I don't like when people say that. You're attributing personal emotion, right? You're attributing their desires, right? Or their, I don't know how to say, their personal emotional state. Like they're lazy, so they did it, or they're dumb, or they're trying to trick us or take advantage of us. I find that to be very silly, okay? If you have an emotional reaction to any piece of art, that is your reaction, okay? To believe that someone is personally accosting you is a little demented, okay? I'm sorry. I don't mean to make fun of you because I've probably done it too, okay? I shouldn't say it's demented. That I'm doing the same thing there, right? But I'm just saying, I believe in terms of argument's sake, it's faulted, okay? That's what I'll be nice about it, right? I'll be nice about it. I'd start talking about cinematography and all of a sudden I'm calling everyone demented. But anyway, I think you see my point. And I like this. I like this attitude, especially in what you see in our current discourse, Twitter and whatnot. I think it's good. And I think things like this can get a trend going. And I'm going to try to do it. You know that? And I kind of try to do that on this show and in every time I talk about something. So I'm going to talk about this list. This is a great list. And then I made a list of 9 or 10 films that I think are worthy of being looked at for modern cinematography. Now, I'm only going to go over the top 10 here, but they did do a full 100, which I will put in the show notes at theasc.com. But this is the top 10, okay? Starting with number 10. And I guess they're not supposed to be, they're in an order, but they have to be in order, you know? So, I guess they're supposed to be all great, but this is their top 10. Number 10, The French Connection, shot by Owen Roisman, directed by William Friedkin, 1971. I mean, what can you say about The French Connection? It's a fantastic film, the greatest car chase probably in film history. And also just the way that it was, in many ways, I mean, The French Connection is a auteur-driven film, as was from 1971. The time period tells you all you need to know. But it was also a huge film, and it became a hit, and it was both commercially and critically successful. Number 9, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Come on. 1968, shot by Jeffrey Unsworth, with additional photography by John Alcott, and directed by Stanley Kubrick, Douglas Trumbull, special effects. In my mind, the best shot film of all time, the best film of all time. It's perfect. It's beautiful. I mean, I could... All right, one time, look, people, to me, I could tear up just looking at this scene when Frank Poole and David Bowman are talking and Hal is hearing them through by reading their lips. Just the way that shot, the series of edits, how clean it is, how centered it is. It's just, it's fantastic. And even initially in the beginning of the film, when there is the kind of press conference on the moon, that to me, just that room where it takes place, where he then kind of, there's a little bit of like, they take the photographs, then they ask people to leave, then they actually talk about what they found, the monolith, I think is so expertly shot. How to shoot in a box. It is a masterclass of how to shoot in a box, and I absolutely love it. Days of Heaven, Nestor Almendros, directed by Terrence Malick. Of course, the whole film shot at the golden hour. They waited every day. A monumental achievement and just a wonderful film. Number 7, The Conformist, shot by Vittorio Storaro. I can't pronounce anything. Directed by Bernardo Bertolucci, a fantastic film. So, again, so clean. Number 6, Raging Bull, Michael Chapman, Martin Scorsese. What can you say about Raging Bull? Revolutionized the way, I think, a lot of way, you know, Scorsese doesn't get enough credit for, first of all, the final concert of the band, right? The last waltz, and Raging Bull's fight scenes, that he changed the way music, and he was a cameraman on Woodstock too, wasn't he? The way music and, or was that Coppola? No, I think Scorsese was a cameraman at Woodstock. The way concerts, but also the way sports is shot in film, a different way to really take it out there. I mean, it was boxing, obviously, but you saw that later on with like helmet cams, things like that, straight up. You know, he really did that. I mean, pieces of those were taken from other people. Like, let's not forget that film is not only a collaborative effort, but the homage. You don't call it stealing in film. You call it an homage, because it's just, you can't, it, that's the way the visual palette is. Something becomes recognizable to people and then other people can do it. That's the way it works. So you don't, there's no such thing as stealing in film. It's all theft. It's all fake anyway. It's all a lie. Number 5, The Godfather, Gordon Willis, Francis Ford Coppola. I mean, what a beautifully shot film. I always think about the toll booth. That was weird. I don't know why, but that one, why am I bringing up the thing that is weird to me? But that toll booth was always weird to me. There was not enough people around it. There's an eerie, an otherworldness about it. Maybe that's why I remember it. But I mean, you can't say enough about The Godfather. I mean, I think Heath Snowlow talked about it on the film list. Citizen Kane, come on, let's cut a hole in the floor and put the camera in it and shoot up. All right? Greg Tolan, Orson Welles. Orson Welles really shot that. I think we know that. I mean, some of these too, like, you know. Okay, I don't think Coppola shot The Godfather. Scorsese working with Chapman. You know what I'm saying? Malick? Kubrick? All right. Next up, Apocalypse Now. Oh, if you have never seen a filmmaker's Apocalypse, you must see it. It is so great and not talked about enough. And when I tell people about it, sometimes they go, oh, what's that? You know, is that like a special features? No, it's like one of the best documentaries on filmmaking ever made. You must see it. Fantastic. You must see it. Of course, Apocalypse Now. So much innovation. My God. Also, this is what I talk about where images, when they say something like a picture paints 1,000 words or something, I think in film there should be something like, you know, a scene launches 1,000 films because the helicopters dropping the napalm in Apocalypse Now is, of course, taken from so many World War II films that Coppola grew up on, that all those guys, Spielberg, Coppola, all these guys freaking, these guys grew up on this stuff. And so much of it is this, you know, is the auteur lens on the popular subject, right? They were fed pop, and what came out of it is somehow their artistic vision. But a lot of it is based on that. So when you think about that shot, but then you think about, like, my God, how many times has that been recreated? Or like, you think like Michael Bay made his career on stealing that. Like his whole entire career is stealing that shot and then making a robot jump and punch something. Number two, Blade Runner. Come on. Jordan Cronenwelf, directed by Ridley Scott. Of course, I mean, what is Blade Runner? Is it a movie? It's an experience. It's gorgeous. It's weird. The plot, everything is ethereal. It exists in its own time and space, and yet it created what is supposed to be a future. And a future which I think in many ways we are fighting against. These kind of bifurcated cities, you know, where the rich live on the top and the poor on the bottom. But what a monumental achievement of mixing the special effects with the practical, and also inspired in many ways, I think, by Tartakovsky and so much of his work. And I think it doesn't get enough credit there. But Blade Runner is fantastic. Lawrence of Arabia, number one, shot by Freddie Young, directed by David Lean, an epic on an epic scale, 1962, kind of the, maybe you think the height of this, right? And I'm surprised that there's no Westerns on this list. I thought maybe The Searchers would be on the top 10. I think Lawrence of Arabia is fantastic and wonderful. But I'm gonna sound like a person who loves everything made in the 70s. It's great. It wouldn't be my number one, but it's a fantastic film. I mean, there's nothing to acting too. There's nothing you can say bad about it. It's, you know, maybe a little in today's day and age, something might be questionable about it, but as so many films are, I mean, even the color in it, right? To achieve that level of color against the sand. And I mean, I remember seeing that on film and just, I don't even remember what the hell happens in it. I got to be honest with you. All I remember is the images and things moving, right? And the camera being still and then moving along with things. Wonderful. All right. So really quick, here's my 10 and then I'm going to get out of here. I want to suggest these 10 films because I haven't been talking a lot of films. Number one, how can you mention visual cinematography? And these might be a little bit more pop. I went a little bit more pop on this list rather than trying to go for the deep ones, but there's some deep ones here. I'm going to start off with The Matrix, 1999, Lana and Lily Wachowski, the amazing special effects by John Gaeta. It's absolutely revolutionized the way action films are shot and paced, and the amount of intellectual content that can be involved in them. Let's not forget this comes on the heels of like Arnold Schwarzenegger movies being the biggest action movies, or something like, I don't know, was Bad Boys out yet? You know, I mean, come on, The Matrix was amazing. And I think it deserves all the credit in the world. I think it's probably on the 100 list. But as far as the cinematography and how it was shot, Bill Pope, the guy's a genius. I mean, the guy's amazing. You look at his resume and it's fantastic. This is not just, you know, but he's worked in so many different areas, and popular and non-popular music, just tons of stuff. So great cinematographer, and The Matrix does not get enough credit in my book. Number two going for me, and this is no particular order, The Blair Witch Project. It has to be on there. You might not like this shaky Steadicam, and you might say, well, that's not cinematography. That is what cinematography is. Cinematography is not just setting up shots, right? This is why I am not a cinematographer or a DP. I would be a director because I don't know. I mean, the depth of knowledge that's necessary, camera types, lenses, light, how things work. But generally, it's the choice of the style in which a film's going to be shot, but also the extent to which you adhere to that style. And Blair Witch, though it was really, there is no cinematographer on it. It's the directors, Daniel Merrick and Eduardo Sanchez. It was the actors, Heather Donahue, Michael Williams, and Joshua Leonard, who actually shot the damn thing. There were some parts where I think somebody else picked up the camera, but you know, they supposedly sent them out. I think in the beginning, they sent them out there and they just shot the thing. But the cinematographer to be the person, right, is something that has become ubiquitous now. Think about the movie we just talked about that is a big film this year that people like, Searching. Think about all the Record movies, all of the other horror movies, Paranormal Activity. Those are just the obvious choices, okay? But the stylistic changes that Blair Witch created they're innumerable in huge directors like Soderbergh, Michael Mann. Like, it was crazy. The digital film divide. And the fact that they had such good sound, right? This is something that I'm going to talk about when I talk about with another filmmaker here, but the understanding that you can take more chances in cinematography when you have great sound design. That's very important in film. Next up, Reservoir Dogs. I mean, come on. Tarantino? Look, say what you will about Quentin Tarantino. And let me just say that Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, cinematography, Andres Sekula. And then he's worked with the best, but also Quentin Tarantino likes to steal the camera for them and tell them where to shoot. And the guy is perfection, baby. Look, I'll tell you, I think that there's few perfectly shot films, and Quentin Tarantino's pretty much all of his films are nearly perfectly shot. Follow my internal rules of where the camera should go next and what is adventurous and bold, and especially this, don't effing cut, okay? When you're doing a pull, if it's a zoom you're doing, or you're doing a focus pull, if you're doing a freaking dolly shot, if you're doing anything, don't stop. Make it 10 seconds long, and Tarantino loves it. He takes every aspect of junkie, from the junkiest of American exploitation, Hong Kong, even because not all of it's great, people, okay? The garbagey type shots that people do, he does them and he makes them great. And then he'll steal from the masters and he'll pull it off. You know, the stuff that he stole from Sisters for Kill Bill was beautiful. I mean, I can't say enough about Quentin Tarantino. This not says anything about the man or some of the content of his films, which sometimes I'm not a huge fan of. I love the guy, but that's not, it's the film. He is so perfectly framed. Every single effing shot is perfectly framed. And he spends time on it and stops and looks and then thinks about what the shot before, what the shot after, how it works in there. He comes back to things within the same scenes, and then within the same film, he'll wait an hour and then come back to a visual cue. He's amazing. And it all started with Reservoir Dogs, and it's so simple. It's a shot in a box, right? In a warehouse. And it's amazing. But of course, not, you know, the parts that aren't are amazing too. But I think Reservoir Dogs did so much for modern cinema. City of God. City of God, 2002, directed by Fernando Meirelles and Kaita Lund. The director, the cinematographer, I should say, is Cesar Chalon. And this film, shot in the favelas in Brazil, was groundbreaking in so many ways and led to a resurgence in America, at least, of the acceptance of foreign films, I think. And I think City of God, because it came on the heels of, and, you know, past, you know, what Reservoir Dogs had already been released a long time ago, Pulp Fiction, all that. But to see that kind of vitality in a different culture, a different language, with kids too, the level of violence it had, there was just a lot of things that were attractive to kind of the indie heads at that time. And City of God was just a huge hit. People loved it. And it propelled, I think, a generation. I think when you see films like The Florida Project, they owe a lot to City of God, because it influenced American filmmakers and filmmakers all around the world, remembering to that, yeah, The Matrix, but there's also grabbing a camera and running around, like Blair Witch, you know? It's the other side of the coin. So if you haven't seen City of God, I'm not talking much about story here, but it's a fantastic moving story as well. But the way it's shot, it's sun-drenched, it's fast. Sometimes the camera lingers, and sometimes it just moves quicker than your eyes can even see. It's just a fantastically shot and film. It's staged well. You know, it's shot on the ground outside, real. And you can tell too, sometimes people are looking at the camera, you know, and to see that again in 2002, it was really refreshing, because it was very reminiscent of like the French New Wave. And I think that it really did influence a lot of filmmakers in their visual palette. All right. Panic Room. This movie gets shit on. It wasn't the best movie in the world. 2002, same year of City of God, directed by David Fincher. Cinematography by Conrad Hall and Darius Kondju. And Kondju. This film is one of the first films ever where they, and really the film in many ways, the story is secondary to David Fincher's idea of having the camera be able to be anywhere. And the idea of digitally mapping rooms and areas, and the camera can go anywhere and it's not physically there, right? It's a special effect where the actual camera is and how it moves, and it's groundbreaking. And I could watch Panic Room with the sound turned off. Like I said, I mean, Jodie Foster, it started Kristen Stewart's career. It did have some good roles. Dwight Yoakam, I always famously remember that Dwight Yoakam played Raoul, and that was originally supposed to be Maynard James Keene is that his last name? From Tool. It was supposed to be in that role. Jared Leto, But really a fantastic film for the way that it took the camera physically anywhere in the shot, and the melding of the digital and the real, and still perfectly framed. And I had to have a David Fincher film on here, so I'm going to pick Panic Room, because I think in the future people will see this as a revolutionary film. But again, not really for the plot. Let's see. The next one I have is Throwback 2001, Spy Kids, Robert Rodriguez. One of the first films successfully, I should say, shot like entirely digitally against a green screen. We've seen cartoons and other films do this before, but the spirit that Rodriguez had, and this was later in his career, you know, he had already done a lot, and this was shot like in his backyard, in his barn that he converted into a studio that his whole family and his wife's the producer, or was, I believe they're separated now. And then people just came out to his house and shot this. And I just love the spirit of it. And I really think that Rodriguez is a really important director, and his choices of what he makes is not, he might not be the best writer in the world, but I think he's still important. And, you know, I think he's forgotten a bit today's day and age. Him and Tarantino were so hot, and now Tarantino is Tarantino. Everybody knows who that is. He's a master. And Rodriguez is kind of like the fun guy with a cowboy hat, and, you know, he's making some Battle Angel Alita or something, you know? But he really was revolutionary in his spirit. And I remember reading his book back in the day, so I had to shout out Spy Kids for, honestly, it reminded me of the show, the film that was actually started earlier but came out 3 years later, which is Sky Captain Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. And it basically was the same idea. The guy wanted to create a movie on a green screen and like just shoot it in his basement. And then he ended up doing like a short, and then eventually like Gwyneth Paltrow was in it and all this, and it didn't do too well, but he used a lot of the same kind of technology that Rodriguez used in Spy Kids. And I know it sounds funny, cinematography, and then you're talking about Spy Kids as a technology, but I think it is cinematography because it's a decision of where the camera is and how it interacts and how the visual palette is created. And I think Spy Kids is actually pretty revolutionary. Magnolia. How can I not mention Magnolia? Robert Elswit, one of the greatest ever, and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, 1999. It's an epic drama. And epic is just one word for it. I'm not even going to mention the cast, the acting, the falling frogs. These things really do happen, and it's a wonderful story. But a part of that It is one of the best shot films ever. It's because it takes so many chances and it's freaking successful on like all of them. I mean, a cast wide musical number and how that's shot, the rain, the use of close ups and mid shots, the Steadicam. It's just, I mean, it is an example. Okay, I often say on the show when like somebody gets money and they go crazy. Well, that's exactly what Paul Thomas Anderson did with Magnolia, except he's a freaking genius, so it all worked out. And I think that actually, in many ways, Magnolia stopped a trend in film. And I really believe this. And I think that you saw so many movies like this that were coming out around this time. And it was building because of the reaction in the kind of indie film auteur world to the Tarantino and the Rodriguez and the levels of violence, right, and action, that you had these kind of anti-that filmmakers, you know, like Paul Thomas Anderson, who is all about emotions and all about characters and ensembles and Hollywood. And I think that Magnolia was so over the top, emotional and crazy and wearing your heart on your sleeve and wearing the camera on your sleeve that it intimidated, like some people were like, whoa, I remember when it first came out, people are similar to what people said about 2001. It's like, you know, it's like cinematic masturbation. He's just pulling out every stop, you know? It's like, come on already. It's like a pop song you hear where it's like so saturated with poppy gooiness. But then there's people who can pull that off and they become the standard bearers. And that's what this is. Magnolia is the standard bearer of taking all these crazy cinematic chances and flourishes. And then, I mean, you see, I mean, just compare this Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love. My God, these like dolly pushes when he goes towards the people. These should not work, but they all work because it's amazing. That's my list. I just had a couple there. I don't think I even had 10, but I just got to talk about some films that when I was looking at this top 10 list, I thought, oh, I should just have some list. There's two actually that I was not going to get too into, but I think are good to mention, which is Forrest Gump, of course, the mixture of the digital and the practical on that. But also, that is a fantastically shot film. Okay, say what you will about Forrest Gump, but the way that it blends the digital stuff worked, but also the kind of stock cheesy way it shot really works. And I just want to point out Forrest Gump because it's like how to make one of these saccharine dramas work. And the other one, which is on the totally opposite end of the scale, which is my belief has inspired a whole generation of horror and acid tripped out psychedelic films, and that is Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void. This is a fucking crazy movie. I can't even describe it. It is like taking an acid trip. It is beautiful and it is insane, and he messes with everything. From perspective to aspect to keeping the camera sideways for like excruciatingly long periods of time. It's crazy. And it's just a visual feast. And I think that it is super popular. It's way more popular than people talk about Enter the Void. It's crazy. And it inspired a lot of people. And I think that when you see like Mandy and films like that are inspired by some of the chances that Enter the Void. And even though it was earlier films, Irreversible and stuff, it's similar, okay? But I think Enter the Void, the reason why I picked that is because I think it's in many ways a culmination of a vision, which now since – has maybe petered out or is repetitive, but at the time was like, whoa, amazing. So check out Enter the Void. All right, that's all I got for you today. Remember to check us out at dvrpodcast.com. Email us, dvrpodcast@gmail.com. Check us out on Twitter at dvrpodcast. And go join our Facebook group. Get in our cufflinks.com giveaway there. Well, it's a contest. It's not a giveaway. Pick who you think's going to win this weekend. And just do me a favor. I mean, that New England Chargers game is really giving me straights. I'm more interested in why. The more I think about it, the more I really want to see it. This is one for the ages because this could be it for one of these guys. And I think this might be what they're talking about. I'm trying to think about what the theme going in, you know, blah, blah. I'm not going to watch a pregame garbage where they make jokes with old guys. But like when they're first talking about it, well, here we are now in New England. Is it going to be like the aging QBs? I think that is it, because this could be the end for one of those guys. Well, hey, those were fun movies. And if you have a list of any films that you think are like, my list was kind of, it was just films I wanted to talk about and things that I thought were important from a cinematographical point of view. And if you have the same visual films that you want to share with us, send them in, dvrpodcast@gmail.com. That's all I got, folks. Peace out.